a concert this summer.
Just enter the KBOO Summer Music Raffle, where three lucky winners will choose in order from three awesome events.
You could win 2 3-day passes to the Northwest String Summit, July 19th to the 21st.
A pair of Sunday tickets to Pickathon, August 4th.
A pair of tickets to Lord Huron and Shaggy Graves at the Oregon Zoo, August 12th.
Tickets are just $5, and if you buy 4, you get an extra raffle chance for free.
Enter at kboo.fm/give, or you can buy tickets in person at Music Millennium or Grendel's Coffee.
Deadline to enter is July 7th. See kboo.fm/summermusicraffle for full rules and details.
Enter now for your chance to win.
Hello out there, this is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of the OCA, Walt Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric, and police departments telling you what you should listen to, stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio, 90.7 on your FM dial unless your FM was made in America.
Coming this Monday,
June 17th at 11 p.m.,
KBOO's original bedtime radio show for grown-ups, Gremlin Time. We continue our presentation of
The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy by Cliff Nesteroff.
This week, the late 1950s to the early 60s, when Red Fox was bringing comedy to vinyl, when the show business establishment absolutely hated Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul, the tragedy of Jonathan Winters, the triumphs of Dick Gregory, and the biggest disaster of Jerry Lewis's career. All this coming this Monday,
June 17th at 11 p.m.
on the Bedtime Radio Show for Grown-Ups, Gremlin Time.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, this is Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. Joining me again is...
Elliot Gilland, and happy to be back.
Thank you for joining me again.
Yeah.
Great. So we'll jump right into it because we are always short of time. A lot has been happening since the last time we were on the air, but something that's very pressing, something that actually has implications this afternoon, in fact, is something you may have noticed. You know, when you go to airports every now and then, you'll see potentially, last time I flew out of Portland, there was a picket happening out by the Uber and Lyft area, the rideshare area. So every now and then you do kind of notice protests happening, but for the most part, things tend to flow smoothly as you move through an airport. You don't necessarily notice the people working there as much as you notice the travelers around, and, you know, they're kind of, the workers are usually secondary. But as of this week, there are workers in 13 cities, part of the union Unite Here, at airports in 13 cities voted unanimously in favor of going on strike. These workers are subcontractors with companies, most notably LSG Sky Chefs and Gate Gourmet. They're the folks who load the food onto the planes so that when you are sitting there, you know, you get snacks or sometimes you buy drinks or larger meals. They're the people who actually make that possible for you. They're the people who load them onto the planes and make sure there's enough meals there for everyone. Those workers are currently in mediation with the companies that they work for, but they have opted, they've all voted to pull out of mediation if the National Mediation Board allows them to, and they've opted to go on strike in order to, the biggest things they're pushing for are, as always, higher wages and better benefits from their employers.
Yeah.
These workers are, as I mentioned, subcontractors, so as we've discussed many times in this show, you know, you have employees, and oftentimes employees from, you know, big companies or small companies can get squeezed and maybe don't make enough money and sometimes don't have great benefits. And then there's the contractors and subcontractors who oftentimes get screwed even more than that. So these folks,
often without health care.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. And so there's about 10% of the workers in these 13 cities in this profession can actually afford to cover a family member on their employer provided health care plans. The average worker earns about $28,000 a year. Many of them support families on that wage, which, you know, in some like the cities that are included in this are Boston, Dallas, Los Angeles, Miami, Minneapolis, New York, Orlando, Philadelphia, Seattle, San Francisco, Tampa, Florida, and Washington, D.C.
And these are high, basically, these are high cost cities.
Exactly.
These are not cities that you are able to live on $28,000 a year. And I think it's important to note, too, while they're subcontractors, these are not necessarily positions where you're moving up or exactly. that you're, you know, some teen who is now working at this job and it's just a stopping or a stepping stone into something greater. A lot of times this is the profession for you. So, basically without any movement or anything like that, these people are, like you said, getting squeezed.
Exactly. And that's, you know, one of the things that these, like, just like you said, these jobs and low wage jobs are so often portrayed by the media and also by management as stepping stones or as, you know, jobs for teenagers, entry level jobs.
Yep.
But as we know, from the past few years of organizing to raise the minimum wage, that's actually not the case. The majority of those people working in these jobs are older people who are supporting a family on these jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so of course, $28,000, I mean, I don't know necessarily what the average cost of living is in some of the smaller, you know, second tier, third tier cities in this country, but all the cities on this list, these are all top tier cities, and I cannot imagine any single one of them you being able to earn $28,000 and also yep. afford rent and you yep. know food and all those things.
And yeah, and I think another common argument is a lot of the shared economy, right? So it's we'll get an Airbnb or get a Uber, start driving Uber on Lyft. And the thing there, which we went into a little bit last month, is that those are not nearly as lucrative as they seem. Most of these
right.
people aren't accustomed to saving money aside for taxes or even calculating depreciation on a vehicle or even an asset
right.
like something like an ADU in the back of a home that you're renting out. So when I hear the Uber as a side job, I get pretty upset because that's not really the answer for most folks, I don't think.
Of course not.
Especially when a lot of people in this situation are probably most likely renting the car from Lyft and Uber. So on top of the fact that they aren't making as much as they think, they're also paying a lot of that back just to rent a car that they're able to drive. Because I think here in Oregon, it's different per state, I believe. But in Oregon, you have to have a car that's within the last 10 years. So you
yeah.
need a 2009. And so a lot of people can't do that, so they rent it from the company.
Yeah, which then, of course, you know, that's another cost on top of that people maybe weren't factoring into the base wage
exactly.
they're earning there.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so, you know, one of the, like something like you just mentioned, the fact that these workers are in fact subcontractors, they're contract workers, means that they likely are not going into the job factoring in the fact that they need to hold out their own wages. They need to, you know, set aside money in order to pay off the tax burden at the end of the year, something that you generally assume your employer is going to do, and you, when you are a full-time employee of a company, they do take care of. But as a contract worker, you're responsible for doing that, and that's not something that people often think about doing or have the resources to do,
mm-hmm.
especially earning as little as these workers do earn.
Another thing I think
yeah.
that's important to note is that I think a lot of people, when you say an airline worker's striking, right? I think a lot of people would say, oh, well, in my head, the airlines are doing really poorly. But I think the market has consolidated greatly, and there's a lot less airlines than there were before. So I think in the statement that they put out basically from Unite here, they talk about how there are actually record profits, right?
Right.
From these companies, and they aren't, you know, taking those profits and in turn giving livable wages to their staff, right?
And, you know, on top of exactly like you said, I mean, so these companies, they've consolidated the industry. Like, I remember a time when Northwest Airlines was an airline. Like, there were other things like TWA. I mean, all of those are contracted.
There's small random ones like Spirit or something
right.
like that. But I think they're operating on the margins, right? And,
absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
the Deltas and the Southwests of the world and the Virgins. I believe Virgin bought, didn't they buy Alaska?
I think other way around. Alaska bought Virgin.
Oh, sorry.
Virgin.
Other
yeah,
way
yeah,
around.
But same thing, you know.
And
yeah.
so, yeah, that's... The market is different than it was when I think in a lot of people's heads, this is a poor performing market, right?
Right. And I think the media often covers it in that way of like, oh, you know, they're looking to cut costs. But
You know, so not only are they squeezing their employees, but they're also, when we, anyone who travels on airlines notices that over the past, you know, 10, 15 years, they've really been squeezing the traveler as well. You know, there was a time where you used to actually get a meal on most flights. You know, now you're paying for every little thing. You used to be able to check a bag for free. That's often not an option anymore. They've shrunk the size of seats and try to squeeze more people into them. People often get bumped. I mean, like we saw a few years ago with that horrible video of that man being pulled off the United flight for because he had been bumped or whatever it was. I mean, that kind of thing happens a lot less violently all the time.
Yeah.
And so these airlines are, they're making record profits and they're squeezing on both ends, both their labor costs and their, you know, both their labor force and their consumers. So, you know, that's something that is, it's important. And these are workers that are, you know, really behind the scenes. So it's not often seen if they were to take action, but you would definitely notice it as a flyer, as a person, you know, sitting on the airplane, if you all of a sudden didn't have any food options or drink options mm-hmm. on there. So it's something to keep in mind. You know, there was a worker who was interviewed for an article about this who's at San Francisco, so SFO Airport, who has been working, he claimed he's been working 14 hours a day for 6 days a week for 20 years, and he still has to drive Uber on the side and can barely make ends meet. Yeah.
That's just not the really stories depressing. We want to be hearing, yeah.
Exactly. And, yeah, I mean, so one of the things that this just reminds me of what happened during the government shutdown a couple, about 4 months ago or so. I think it was back December to January. The thing that really kind of ended up shutting it down, the thing that broke the camel's back, the straw that broke the camel's back, was the airport workers and specifically the flight attendants union threatening to go on strike. Mm-hmm. And that's what finally shut down that's what brought the government shutdown to an end and got everyone moving again. And when you think about that, I mean, flight attendants not working, that means that you essentially can't have flights, like flights stop. Yep. And the same thing would be true. I mean, I'm sure that they would figure out ways to send flights off without food, but like if these workers were to all stop working in these major hub cities, I mean, most of these are big hubs. Yeah. If those workers were to stop providing the services necessary to make these planes take off, that grounds a lot of flights. And, you know, one thing that, you know, the people in charge, you know, the business owners, the investors, you know, the politicians, they don't often listen to workers making demands, you know, even if they're just in the street, or, you know, even if they're in the street or in their offices. But something they all do listen to is when their profits start to get hurt.
A or strike.
When the profit, you know, yeah, exactly. So a strike that actually affects airport, you know, air travel would have a direct impact on all sectors of the economy, and that would in turn impact the people who make these decisions, and that would force them to pay attention, force them to the table with these workers. So yeah, we saw it happen with the flight attendants in the government shutdown a few years ago or a few months ago. Hopefully, we can see some that kind of a similar type of solidarity with these workers. At the end of the week, they will be doing informational pickets, and in July they could go on strike. So let's keep an eye out for that. Mm. And you know, just to continue on that train there, the flight attendants union, which I mentioned, you know, they're largely the reason that the government reopened. And since that moment, they've really stepped to the forefront of union activism in this country, particularly their leader Sarah Nelson, who's the union president, and something that they have, you know, aside from showing solidarity and helping the government workers by shutting down by threatening to go on strike, something else they've done, they were the first union in this country to endorse the Green New Deal, which is an extremely progressive piece of legislative proposal to deal with climate change and to restructure the economy as a whole in order to reduce carbon emissions and transition people. Workers in carbon intensive areas of the economy, sectors of the economy, into low carbon intensive areas.
Yeah, and I think the reason why that's so huge is because not only are, you know, and I think this will be a theme as we kind of hit our other topics from our show notes, but this is really big because it's constantly you're seeing non-union people benefiting from the things that unions are fighting for, right? And so this kind of going into the Green New Deal is unions looking more towards the future and just overall sustainability of an industry more so than the companies that the unions are working for, right? So I think Sarah Nelson was basically talking about how the fossil fuels and the climate are actually more damaging to the airline industry long term than any sort of
any regulations.
And I think that's just so, like, keeping your mind forward and looking to the future is something that I think a lot of people would not credit unions as doing.
Exactly.
I think a lot of people, especially on the right, would probably say unions are looking for short-term just benefits for workers, and it's not almost never the case, right?
So. Yeah, and it's unfortunate because there are some unions that have come out against this, and it's sort of what you expect. I mean, the more reactionary, the more sort of conservative end of unions tends to be the ones, like in the construction trades, the ones that do benefit directly from new fossil fuel infrastructure.
Yeah.
And so, those unions have actually come out and said, I believe it's Richard Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, said that he wants a whole bunch of changes made to the Green New Deal so that workers and our jobs, his quote is, a whole bunch of changes made so that workers and our jobs are protected in the process. Terry O'Sullivan of the Labor's International Union of North America called the Green New Deal a bad deal. And these are, these are the heads of unions that represent people who in the short term would see continued job employment by the building of new fossil fuel infrastructure and things like that. But what I think the larger goal of the Green New Deal and people who are supporting it and, the other unions like SEIU that have come out in favor of it are trying to push across is the message that, in the short term, these jobs that you're used to getting may disappear, but the goal is to have an entire new revolution of, building all kinds of new infrastructure to transition away from fossil fuels, and that's going to require a whole lot of construction, and who better to do that work than the people that are already, that know how to do the fossil fuel side, and let's transition that, the construction trades over to more the greening of the economy. And so that, there is a rift in the union world, but they're in the labor movement for these progressive policies, but the fact that two major unions have come out in favor of this, and on top of that, so the union heads and the boards of these unions have voted SEIU and the Flight Attendants Association have voted to support the Green New Deal. But even beyond that, the workers, the rank and file within those unions, there was a new survey that came out from the data think tank Data for Progress, and they discovered that 52% of current union members support the Green New Deal as opposed to 22% that are opposed to it. And so, that shows that the vast majority of actual rank and file union members of workers recognize the value of this and support, even if their unions don't necessarily push for that.
The polling data doesn't really support the narrative. Basically, there is the story, right?
And isn't that always the case, that the people at the top maybe don't always represent the people who, the general population as much as you'd think they would? And so that brings us to the main topic that we want to discuss tonight, which is basically the need to have solidarity across different movements. And so if specifically flight attendants or service workers who may work in industries that are not directly impacted by regulations from the Green New Deal, if they're coming out in support of this, then and then they're supporting workers who actually would benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that needs to happen more often. And so a key part to getting more, a key part to this is getting more younger white collar workers to recognize that they are in fact part of the working class.
They are labor as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, so we've seen a lot of that over the last year to 2 years, really, of like sort of cracks in the armor of, of the ideology that surrounds people who work in offices, just because you may work in an environment where there's ping pong tables and there's, beer on tap and you get, catered meals and things like that. It doesn't necessarily mean that the dynamic between you and your employer is any different than someone who works at a restaurant or someone who, works in a job where they're making minimum wage.
Yep.
Like, you still are an employee, and the person who employs you, even though they might pay you more, the fact that they pay you more means that they're making more money off of the labor you're doing than you're receiving back.
And I think it's also not, I think the culture of, one, the fact that people don't really talk about what they make is important here, because I think it's not always more than you think, right? So I think two of the most important, really huge labor wins that we saw in the last couple months here is the Vox and also Vice labor unions, who have both basically ratified new deals with their management companies. Vox, which just happened a couple days ago, I think last week.
Yeah, it was within the past few days.
Yeah. And so I think a really important thing there is, in terms of the solidarity across like types of workers, is I think there was a lot of toxic communication online about the whole thing. You know, we were talking before the show, I saw a tweet from a Daily Wire employee who basically was saying that, oh, your $2,000 MacBook that you're using to do Photoshop for some media company, right? That's what terrible conditions you must be working under, right?
Yeah, and how dare you? Yeah.
I think when you don't think about it at all, that makes a lot of sense.
Right, in a vacuum, that makes a lot of sense.
But the problem is that this person doesn't get to sell their laptop to pay their rent, right?
Exactly.
In the same way that a factory worker doesn't get to sell the conveyor belt to make, you know, either if they have a medical emergency or rent or whatever, right? So I think it can be misleading. And I think, as you were saying, these different groups of workers are all just labor. And when you think of yourselves as different, right, if you think of the person who, like you were saying, the person who comes and delivers the catered food as different than the person who's writing the editorials, that's when you're losing.
Exactly. And, you know, yeah, just because you work in an environment that has all these amenities, it doesn't mean that you as the individual, like, you get those because they want you to stay at work longer. They want to get more production out of you. And they oftentimes, you know, you'll get a situation where, like, yeah, we have this really cool office where you can work in beanbag chairs over here, or, you know, you can, you know, you can go take a break and play ping pong or you know, foosball. But a lot of that is in lieu of, you know, they provide those amenities in lieu of actually paying you more, providing better benefits to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have started to see some cracks in that armor. Over the last year, there were walkouts around the world, actually, of Google workers, who, you know, it was not necessarily to deal with a specific wage issue or anything that some of the lower paid workers oftentimes walk out over, but it was over an issue that doesn't need to be dealt with, which is sexual harassment in the work environment, and specifically strengthening the policies to deal with that and to mitigate that. Now, those workers at Google, they did walk out for about an hour, I believe, during the day, but that's a step in the right direction, you know?
Yeah, and I think it really shows two, not super different industries, but two different areas where the workers are at a different stages of kind of their fight for, you know, benefits, right? So Google's kind of at their walkout stage, whereas Vox and Vice were at the, hey, you know, this is not acceptable living conditions. And I think the big difference there is, like, the freelancer kind of editorial life can be pretty difficult. I did want to just quickly run through just some of the stuff that they got in this Vox basically a media deal. So they got some minimum starting salary, which is great. And on top of that, they got basically guaranteed annual raises. I think a lot of people would have assumed they already had that. But they did not, right? They also hit a bunch of salary floors on different job categories. So that's beyond just the writers. So again, that's kind of another unions fighting for something that benefits people outside their, basically, the own group, because the Vox union is mostly just creatives.
Correct, yeah.
They also secured company-provided health benefits for part-time employees who work more than 20 hours a week.
Which is huge.
Huge, yeah. Right? Because a lot of these people, they're being kept under that previously, or, you know, they're being kept at a certain amount of hours where they didn't get that before, depending on the state. And so I think that's incredibly huge. So that's great. They also got 16 weeks of paid parental leave for full-timers, regardless of gender. And then they also got 4 weeks of paid time off for ill family members who are in immediate danger. Yeah.
And that's so important. You know, the maternity and paternity leave, regardless of gender, is such an important thing, because when you just provide, you know, if you were as a company to provide just maternity leave, that inherently it disadvantages female workers, because, you know, the assumption when hiring, choosing between a man and a woman, the assumption would be, well, if the female employee that we're about to hire were to get pregnant, they would be entitled to maternity leave, therefore we'd lose their productivity here, versus the male employee who would never get that, and therefore we don't have to worry about that. So providing it equal on both sides actually does.
Takes it out of the equation.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think that's a, you know, that kind of goes right into the next note I had, where basically they also got Vox to agree to do a bunch of diversity hiring. So basically 40% of applicants who pass the phone interview stage will be from backgrounds that are typically underrepresented in journalism, right?
That's great.
So that's great. And then finally, the last thing, which we'll touch on, is basically they just got 11 weeks of minimum severance, which is, I think, an important topic to just kind of pause on here for a second, because I think a lot of people assume that that's something that also happens a lot in tech companies, when it does not. Also, SF-based Telltale Games had a huge, I think it was end of last year or something like that.
Yeah, I believe it was.
They basically, you know, they thought they had some venture capital coming. They had budgeted it out and they didn't quite make it. And they, on the spot, fired basically 95% of their employee base. So I think that 11 weeks, especially in a really volatile environment like journalism right now, mm-hmm. where, you know, if you aren't getting the ads or you don't have the subscription base, I think that that's huge, the 11 weeks of severance. So
absolutely. Which, I mean, you know, it's one of those things that you don't think about, but one of the things we do talk about in the show a lot is the idea that, okay, even though you might be in a position where those workers may have been making more than your general minimum wage worker or low paid worker, they likely don't have a lot saved, especially because those jobs tend to exist in very expensive cities like New York, San Francisco,
and they've
Los
moved
Angeles.
There a lot of the times.
Exactly. Yeah. So they've moved there. They don't have much saved. If you're without expecting it, you're fired. You may not have enough saved to continue to live in that city to find another job there.
Yep.
So severance is a huge issue that I think doesn't get discussed quite enough.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of this is like benefits, right, that other types of labor have fought for a long time and kind of take for granted. So, again, I think the theme of this today's show, I think, is, you know, solidarity across different boundaries here, right?
Right.
And when everyone realizes that they're labor, that's when more people are going to win, because, you know, things that I think people take for granted because you're on a MacBook Pro, right, they just assume you've got certain things.
Yeah.
And you're dressed a certain way or, you know, what have you. So I think that just kind of, the more workers that stand together, it's going to be better.
And, you know, it's some of the rhetoric that we don't even think about coming out of political spheres or media spheres about, you know, discussing, you know, we need good middle class jobs, or, you know, we need to help the middle class. Mm-hmm. I think that's actually pretty damaging oftentimes to this class consciousness, because, you know, yeah, you may, as the person working at one of these, you know, fancy offices or one of these more exceptional jobs, may see yourself as middle class when really you're more precarious than you realize, and you're actually, you know, unless you own your business, unless you are, you know, independently wealthy, you're part of the working class whether you realize it or like it or not.
Yeah.
And so developing that class consciousness, developing that class solidarity is really important. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think that did start to, you know, a lot of this has happened in the last couple of years, and what preceded that was a lot of organizing to raise the minimum wage in fast food environments, and also, you know, teacher walkouts across the country. So these workers who are very comfortable in their jobs, seeing things like that, realizing, well, we just walked out for an hour, but these workers at hotels, you know, like the Marriott strike that happened in the Bay Area, they were out on strike for 2 months. And those people have much more to lose. So if they're as brave to do that, then why are we just walking out for an hour?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think you hit it on the head. They have so much to lose. And also, they're at so much more risk of being automated.
Exactly.
And I think these exceptional, like, we call them exceptional today, but I think those are in much more dangerous positions to be automated than a lot of people think.
Exactly.
So these things need to be fought for now. Instead of feeling safe about it and not kind of acting.
Yeah, and just realizing that these workers have more in common than they do differences. You know, they're both fighting the automation, you know, whether it's on the side where that's creating that and realizing they don't like the ends of it, or the people who are bearing the brunt of it, having them their jobs replaced by different types of automation. There's more solidarity across those people who are employees than there are between, you know, than there are between them and their bosses. And so that's a really important point, I think, that we will unfortunately have to end on right there. This is a discussion that we will definitely continue moving forward with this show. I'll be back next month, a month from now, in July. Elliot, thank you so much for joining
me. Yeah, no, it's a great time. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And if anyone out there is interested in continuing this conversation, you can reach out to me on Twitter. My handle is @MichaelBcath, and I'd love to keep the conversation going with you. Until next month, have a great night.
Huh?
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Baby, you understand me now.